Hello and welcome to the OMFEV podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. On this week's episode, we talk about sustainable infrastructure and development. This is Kat Tusita, Deputy Head of Research in OMFEV. And today we are joined by Mina Sekiguchi from KPMG, where she is Regional Energy and Natural Resources Co-Leader for Asia Pacific and National Sector Head of Energy and Infrastructure for Japan. We also have Jing Donghua, Vice President and Treasurer of the World Bank. Thank you, both of you, for joining us today. We're all experiencing COVID-19 and the disruption from it, and it has really shown us the importance of reliable infrastructure networks, you know, getting key workers to where they need to be, getting goods and equipment to the people who need them the most. And this is all happening at a time when there is also greater awareness of climate risks and the need for more sustainable energy sources. Would you say that the pandemic has somewhat sped up the interest in green infrastructure projects, or is it slowing it down because on the sort of supply side, there might be some disruption or delays in project development? And what role will infrastructure have in the green recovery?
Thank you very much, Kat, and thank you for having me for this discussion. I'm very much honored and happy to participate in this discussion with both of you today. So speaking about how COVID-19 affected the momentum of a global fight against the climate change and the effort, the energy transition, first, many people thought that the COVID-19 slowed down the momentum. But after a while, we see that the reality was completely opposite, generally speaking, in the long term. The most obvious reason would be that the keyword of the climate change or the green was one of the fewer drivers to accelerate the economic recovery of the pandemic. The government in many nations have developed the economic recovery package centering around the green technology or green infrastructure these days. So I believe this is kind of surprising coincidence, but because of the COVID-19, it could also be said that we suddenly jumped the time about 4 or 5 years forward in developing green infrastructure, even though there might be some delays or some of the hiccups in the supply chain and something like that at the time, but in the long term, I guess it's accelerating it. And other aspect is that it's very interesting that COVID-19 is now that people are not encouraged to travel long distance due to the fact that they might carry the virus from one place to the other. In short, seems like COVID-19 will accelerate more decentralization of the cities and communities, right? Now, quite a big cities are considered to be risky, so it is better that people are living in a smaller communities where they can have access to all their necessities without riding onto our public transportation and those kind of things. So ultimately, well, this might be a little bit trouble for the public transportation sector, but ultimately, this could be the real start of thinking seriously about the smart cities now. Renewable energy and the concept of a virtual power plant fit very nicely to this decentralized world. And one thing we should not forget is the fact that the digital is essential to make it work. So the investors to the future green infrastructure might have to be also looking at those kind of technology and also that town as a system infrastructure, in addition to the types of infrastructure assets that we are used to looking at. So that's some of the observation that I have right now.
Yeah, I think with most people working from home, having to transition to remote services, it's really put an emphasis on the need for reliable energy sources and making sure that these sources are sustainable. Jing Dong, do you want to chime in on that?
Yes, absolutely, Kat. First of all, I thank OMFEV for organizing this podcast. Delighted to have the opportunity to share some of our perspectives. And certainly this global pandemic is unprecedented. We project about 150 countries will have negative economic growth this year. So certainly the impact is widespread, but I would really like to focus on many developing countries, especially the poorest countries, the lower middle income country, whose population is unproportionately affected negatively due to this global pandemic. And I think this pandemic actually highlighted even more the critical difference or disparity in development and its impact from preparedness from healthcare system to digital bandwidth to continue education for people in lockdown to road network that is essential now for global e-commerce and logistics to work, right? So we have many, many issues that we have to deal with. I think while we are still in what we would call the relief stage of this pandemic, its long-term impact would still need a lot of time to surface. But I think some early trends are very clear. That is, we need resilient, robust, green infrastructure, be it digital infrastructure, as Mina said, or real infrastructure from energy, green energy, to logistics. All of these elements are critical in the efforts after the pandemic to build resilient, sustainable economy and continue our trajectory in the United Nations goal and the World Bank's goal of global poverty by 2030. So let me stop here, but there are specific topics I'm happy to address. Now, one thing I wanted to mention is that one major impact is the sharp reduction in capital flow to developing countries. Right, we're talking about a huge reduction of over $100 billion remittance that many developing countries rely upon to finance their infrastructure or financing their healthcare system. We're talking about total stoppage of tourism, from which many countries rely on as critical government revenue sources to help build infrastructure. On the other hand, you know, the world is flush with liquidity given the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, Bank of Japan, and higher middle income countries where they have the means to come up with stimulus package. How do we then, from the World Bank perspective, to channel and interest those global savings to go back to finance and development and sustainable infrastructure in the new era post-pandemic is something we are very interested in. So would be very happy to share our journey in working with international capital market in putting sustainability into the conscious mind of investors and to really advocate for, but also in raising actual funds for sustainable development.
Yeah, that's a really good point because we have seen how central banks have responded to the crisis. There's a lot of injection of liquidity, but it's another question whether that's actually transmitted into the real economy and if it's done to finance sustainable projects and activities. And that's something we can talk a little bit more about. Now, just talking again about the whole transition into greener projects and greener infrastructure. Mina, this is something that you've witnessed firsthand in your own career because at the moment you're working a lot on renewable energy and LNG. But you also have extensive experience in oil and gas. So could you just talk a little bit about what that shift has been like in your work and as well as in the broader energy and finance sectors? How has it changed in the last decade or so? And what can we expect in the near future?
Thank you, Kat. Yes, we have started to witness the global capital is fleeing away from carbon assets into more greener assets recently. By the way, EU has finalized the TCFD taxonomy a couple of weeks ago, which some countries agree, and the countries like Japan have some of the points that they cannot agree. The movement started some time ago in Europe, but now we observe the same trend here in Asia too. From my country, Japan, all the three mega banks have already announced to stop investing into a new coal-fired generation project and either reduce their carbon-related loans and investment or withdraw completely from the carbon assets by the year 2050. This really shows how big the pressure from the global capital market is for responding to the climate change risk. Like I said, there's a slightly different view from different countries about the definition of green. In my country, Japan, although last week the government has announced that it will shut down the coal-fired generators of the older than 40 years old, we're talking about some 100 generators existing at the moment, by the year 2030. They still do not stop new, highly efficient coal-fired generators. Japan is also exporting this highly efficient coal-fired generators to the emerging markets, including ASEAN. there are countries still prefer coal for its cheaper and cheaper price and availability. Of course, the coal is regarded as villain in the aspect of climate change risk, but it is practically impossible for those emerging countries which cannot afford expensive fuel and switch its main fuel to LNG or renewable hydrogen all of a sudden. So in this sense, there needs to be a very good transitional plan in which coal will be phasing out gradually while developing greener fuels such as hydrogen or renewable infrastructure and related infrastructure too. But here again, very interesting coincidence happened this year before the COVID-19 happened. In the beginning of 2020, as everybody knows, the oil price crashed because of Saudi versus Russia, in which Saudi continued to produce crude oil. The oil price was minus figure for a couple of days, amazingly. And now the price has coming back, but it's still in the level of $40 a barrel, which is quite low. What happened was that the spot price of LNG was dropped down by this. Actually, there is another reason why LNG price is expected to stay lower for a while, that it's a little bit complicated market story, so we're not going to get into that today. Anyways, because of this lower LNG price, many people anticipate that this could accelerate the switch from coal to gas in emerging markets. Gas ultimately is also emitting CO2, but not as much as coal, but it does. Therefore, it may only be an answer for a period of transition, but because of the fact that the world always needs backup power generation capacity, even in the future, where all the power is from renewables or the hydrogen, so the need for gas will also exist. So that's how things are right now. The important thing is that, of course, ideally, all of a sudden, all the world and the countries can utilize the power which is not emitting any CO2. It's perfect. But then again, the world is not like that, and all the countries have its own background and history and all those kind of different features. So we have to think of the way to accommodate all those kind of things so that one country does not really face the serious, I guess, the damage or the problems in order to just transition into a future.
Maybe just as a follow-up question to that, Mina, what would you say are the important elements for a successful energy transition?
Which is a very, very difficult question. Let's say in Japan right now, the business world is kind of like against the idea of taxonomy from the EU, because it does not accept coal. And Japan wants to still use the coal, and a lot of Japanese power companies are utilizing a coal-fired because it's old and it's still working, means that it does not really take any kind of depreciation cost or anything like that, so they can take all the profit in. And also the fact is that Japan knows that a lot of emerging countries like India or ASEAN countries need a high efficient coal, and it is promoting sort of like exports of infrastructure. So the highly efficient coal-fired plant is one of the things that Japan wants to sell to the world. I guess this taxonomy thing is somewhat political in a way. So what's the right answer? Who knows? And even Europe does not really say anything clear about the nuclear, because there are some of the countries in Europe who are also relying on the nuclear too. So it's obviously it's political discussion. But then again, the thing is that we all agree, all the world will agree that we have to do something for this climate change. But the difficulty exists in the transition or the journey, how the journey should be designed so that everybody could be not happy, but accept.
I agree. It is quite a broad question. My follow-up, just wanted to get your thoughts.
So Kat, maybe I can come in to continue this focus on energy, but expand it a little bit, right? While in Japan, in OECD countries, you do normally have adequate electricity supply and the broadband works. I think in many of the countries we support, just to have reliable energy services is essential in preventing and fighting COVID-19 to start with, right? Because they are necessary for power and healthcare facility, supplying clean water for essential hygiene, providing sufficient refrigeration for the maintenance of food and medicine, critical for digital infrastructure to fight spread of the pandemic, enabling telemedicine, education, so on and so forth. And yet, I just wanted to highlight that in the world that we serve, nearly about 860 million people live without access to electricity, mostly in Africa and South Asia. So in fact, in sub-Saharan Africa, less than one third of health facilities benefit from reliable electricity, and only 43% of the population is electrified at all. So I think we're talking about a different challenge for poor countries, right? And maybe just to share some of the things we are working on, including, you know, how do we make energy greener? And then what are we doing in the capital market very briefly? So one thing we are focusing on is really to make sure that there is reliable energy source to deal with the immediate crisis, to make sure the healthcare facilities are properly powered. Affordability is another big issue that we have to deal with. And so we are working with government, private sector, other partners to address this crisis with the following focus, right? We need to ensure energy access for health and sanitation services. And we need to avert disconnection among the poorest and most vulnerable energy consumers. And we need to support utilities and essential electricity providers to ensure service continuity. We need to promote clean cooking solution to reduce vulnerability to respiratory illness. You know, 3 billion people still cook with pollution to the air. So that's a big issue. And therefore, promoting clean cooking solution is quite essential. So here is, I think, a couple of encouraging signs. Amina talked about low energy price. So this number is below this energy oil price drop to the current low. That is, in that world, just before the COVID-19, renewable energy is now the cheapest option for at least two-thirds of the global population. You know, that's a great state of affairs. And between 2010 and 2018, the adoption of renewable off-grid energy source tripled worldwide. They now represent the best option to connect 40% of Africa who still lack electricity. And also, renewable consumption is growing faster than global energy consumption. I think until 2017, we now have about 17.3% of energy consumption coming from renewable sources. And of course, solar PV and wind will account for most of the renewable-based electricity generation by 2030. So what are we doing in the World Bank? I think we wanted to encourage this trend and take global leadership in promoting green and renewable energy. So we are scaling up our investment in clean energy. For example, in the past 2 years, we have committed about $1 billion for mini grids and standalone off-grid system, with over 80% of new commitment in sub-Saharan Africa. So in the past 5 years, we provided about $9.4 billion in financing for renewable energy and energy efficiency projects in low and middle income countries. That represents about 30% of our energy portfolio in this period. Last year, we committed to about $1.7 billion to renewable energy. It makes up 93% of our generation portfolio. And as I said, 3 billion people continue to cook with polluting fuels. So we decided to help scale up investment for clean cooking by launching a clean cooking fund, which is expected to raise $500 million and be the largest fund of its kind to date. And last year, we convened a global energy storage partnership with over 35 organizations to help expand energy storage and renewable energy in developing countries. And the partnership complements the World Bank's $1 billion battery storage program, which aims to finance 17.5 gigawatts hour of battery storage by 2025, more than triple the current capacity in all developing countries. So look, I mean, we are doing a lot in this space, but as a treasurer of the World Bank, I would be remiss not mentioning that all of this actually are very interested by investors, right? If 20 years ago, investors would buy World Bank bond simply because we are AAA, the credit is great, we offer reasonable yield for AAA, and we are safe name. But starting about 15 years ago, starting with Swedish investor, where they started to figure out that the value of their portfolio is tied to the long-term climate change in the world, right? They started to see how can we support using our liquidity investment in a greener world. And therefore, we were very proud. This was 13 years ago, we actually issued the world's first green bond. It was a couple of hundred million Swedish krona small bond, but now the world's green bond market is over 200 billion. And this is making a difference. And then we now have expanded this concept to use a labeled bond or thematic bond, whether it's green or the SDG bond, sustainable development bond. Now we label every bond we issue to draw investors' attention to increase their appetite in doing good by doing well, right? There is an additional purpose. So Mina, since you're from Tokyo, I wanted to mention, I was quite impressed last year when I was in Tokyo as part of our investor outreach, the overwhelming support from Japanese investors for our bond that we issued in Japan to address global food waste. And that was quite fascinating. We raised about $2 billion. And at the same time, highlighted the fact that food waste is actually the third largest source of pollution after energy and transport in the world. And therefore, it is not about just wasting food, but also about climate change. And also wasted food, wasted a quarter of all the fresh water used in agriculture. So drawing attention to global challenges, and of course, we have issued bond addressing gender inequality, ocean pollution, plastics, education, so on and so forth. So I wanted to use this to highlight there is a global force, which is very positive. Mina, you address the supply side of infrastructure projects, and we address, you know, as a treasurer, we connect that supply of infrastructure through our bond program to global investor base. I think hopefully we will be able to create a better ecosystem to channel global savings to more renewable energy, green infrastructure projects.
Yeah, that's right. So there's been a lot of like really creative and innovative ways that all these financial products that are sustainable that have emerged in the last few years. But something that we consistently hear from some investors is that while there is a very obvious need for infrastructure and there is a need for that infrastructure to be green and to be sustainable, there have been some complaints about the lack of bankable projects. So I'll just bring this back to Mina, and maybe you can talk a little bit about your experience with different projects and investors. And what are the things that are holding investors back from investing in green infrastructure? And what are your thoughts about those who say that there aren't enough bankable projects?
I guess we are in the middle of the journey that all those green, the concept of green or saving the climate or all those kind of things, let's say ESG, is reflected as the value of the asset or the value of our economy or something like that. Let's say like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it's still in a category of, I would say, CSR, which is just a concept and nice to have. But these days, people are putting some values to this ESG, so the green or climate saving kind of things. And that shows in the capital market these days that those companies who are investing more in green asset has the higher stock value and everything like that. So it's reflected as economical value in the world. So I guess the issue here is not whether the project is green or not green. Almost all the infrastructures are facing profitability issues somewhat because we are talking about the public infrastructure where we're not supposed to make a lot of money out of it. The question is if the asset is producing enough return to your investors, return in the money or returns in the value is the question. Just use the value and money in a different sense. These days, the value is probably more reflected in the psychology of the investors these days, and that shows in the capital market that where those stocks or the capital assets valued highly than before. So this is sort of like a very much fundamental issue for the public infrastructure that one of the mission of the public infrastructure asset is to provide social services at a reasonable price and affordable price as we've been discussing. So in the first place, it's not to make a lot of revenue. But when we are talking about the green assets, we are talking about the assets which contribute to reduce the climate risk and saving our future and those kind of things, and how much contribution it will provide if we can make a measurement or visualize this. This could be converted into monetary assets. Good example is a carbon tax. When assets are emitting CO2, it will be counted as a cost to the carbon tax. The flip side is that when it's not, it will be saving cost too. So in that way, that you can say that how much we are saving. So that kind of a similar discussion is in Europe. And many of the large companies now have officially announced that they are aiming for the net zero carbon by the year 2050. This means that they think that they can measure and visualize the CO2 emissions and how much they are saving by, let's say, investing into the renewables. So if they can trade excess savings in the market, now they contributed to the climate, is converted into monetary assets. So what we have to think about here is to be a little bit creative, to have technology such as blockchain to measure and visualize the contribution to saving the world and saving the climate risk, and the market system to convert it into a monetary asset, or at least having some kind of a reference price so that they can calculate how much of value they are creating. So it's sort of like a way to promote investing into greener assets and probably changing the way to look at the asset plan as bankable or not bankable. Am I making sense?
Yeah, I think it just goes to show that there are different ways for different organizations to implement ESG through their portfolio. It could be investing directly in an infrastructure project that, say it was something in solar, wind, or some other form of renewable energy, but it could also be in how that organization's activities.
The renewable energy or anything like that, it's just like a social value. Like, let's say that providing education, providing cleaner housing or hygiene, or those kind of things are all values to the social. And at the moment, we don't really have a scheme or way to just sort of like making it reflected as a value. So we cannot really see it. That's making it really difficult for the investors to think about what to invest.
Okay, so look, I mean, bankable infrastructure projects are a hot topic, right? And certainly the supply project has been a challenge. But I wanted to share one project example that we have done in the World Bank Group that turned the thinking around a little bit. That is an Egyptian solar project that we did a couple of years ago. Look, until recently, Egyptian government spent more on electricity subsidy than it spends on education, healthcare, and social welfare combined. So when the World Bank Group worked with the Egyptian government to figure out a way that how can we encourage investment from private sector and to use whatever, the redirection of electricity subsidy to make the environment more bankable so that you get private sector to put their own money in. So I think it was a very exciting project that we did. We helped the government to structure a mega deal that has installed 6 million solar panels, more than 32 contiguous solar projects across 36 square kilometers Egyptian desert. This is going to become one of the biggest solar installations in the world that will generate 2,000 megawatts of power, lighting up hundreds of thousands of homes and avoid 2 million tons of greenhouse gas emission. But this was done by the private sector, right? Meaning that this became bankable. And what the World Bank has done to help the country to reform its electricity sector, to provide a unified offtake and regulatory environment, and then invited the private sector to bid on the solar project themselves. The private sector arm of the World Bank Group, IC, then worked with the private sector together with MIGA. They brought $1 billion private sector investment in it. So I think there has to be new ways of thinking, because infrastructure has a big regulatory element to it, right? Government offtake, tariffs, toll roads, so on and so forth. How can you turn this into a global standard with a level of transparency, the trust of rule of law, in the country can turn otherwise unbankable projects into bankable projects. But let me switch the topic a little bit because I'm the treasurer. I have to talk about the financing side of it. Kat, you mentioned innovation. You know, I think the word sustainability will have to be now supplemented by the word resilient, because the COVID-19 really has tested the resilience of humanity. And how do we make sure the recovery, the restructuring of the economy, build those resilience into its future shape is quite important. And part of the resilience is to, how do you raise financing to cope with the damage caused by global climate change, and even for that matter, pandemic, right? This is where capital market innovation can play a big role. You know, more than 10 years ago, the World Bank has started to issue what we call capital at risk bonds, or, you know, we call it catastrophe bonds, to use bond format to provide government much needed money when a natural disaster hits. Our latest cat bond actually was the first cat bond we issued for the government of the Philippines. And we did it in Singapore, where we raised money so that if there's a hurricane or earthquake, government would actually receive payout from bond investors. Now, this is in actuality, the effect is similar to insurance, but indemnity insurance takes years to be reimbursed. Whereas a parametric cat bond, once the trigger is triggered, if a level 10 typhoon, whatever it is, the payout is within a couple of weeks without affecting government budget. And investors love it because these fixed income instruments are uncorrelated with the rest of fixed income. So I think I certainly are very optimistic that through the cat bond, and by the way, also issued a pandemic bond, which triggered, which provided almost $200 million to over 60 poorest countries as additional resources to fight the effect of COVID-19. We certainly hope that we will continue to lead global innovation using the power of capital market to address sustainability and resilience.
Thanks, Jingdong. Indeed, we are seeing how important that resilience is because of this pandemic. Mina, do you have anything to add to that? I mean, you are in Japan and you cover Asia Pacific in your work. So there's a lot of exposure. A lot of the countries that you work with are exposed to natural disasters. So do you have any thoughts to add to that?
I guess I'm not really familiar with the financial scheme of saving other countries, casualties and those kind of things. But then again, thing is that here in Japan, we are seeing a lot of heavy rains and typhoons, which have not been happening before. Like at the moment here in Japan, the southern part of the islands have been suffering from the heavy rain every day. And it's reported that the rivers are flooded and many people's houses are shed and they have to evacuate. The problem is that we observe such heavy rains like every year, they said, for the last 4 or 5 years. Obviously, the effect of global warming and everything like that. And I believe that by the fact that we observe the same incident year after year, means that there isn't enough climate preparedness by the Japanese government at the moment, unfortunately. At the same time, I very much understand that there are some reasons for the difficulty of making some of the solutions happen within the nation. For example, in Japan, population is concentrated in big cities, and there are many rural areas with a few population. In short, they don't really have a local budget to fix the problem by itself. Another example would be that there are many rural areas in Japan that high mountains and canyons and winding rivers. Fixing all those kind of natural the resources is by the natural budget is almost impossible. And also the people living in those areas are living there for generations, and they've never thought of leaving the place and all that. So I guess the Japanese government has to do something and a lot to consider, but there seems that there's no easy answer for it. But then again, this is the problem for Japan, and there are other parts of the world which has the other heavier and severe disasters and everything like that. I'm not really familiar with the global financial scheme to say that.
Yeah, got it. So maybe just to close off, we've talked about the energy transition, we've talked about resilience and the importance of that. And really, these are different aspects of sustainability, but we've also seen a bigger interest, especially in recent years, in the social and governance aspect of ESG. So whereas in the past, there's been a heavy emphasis on the environment, we are seeing now greater interest in the S and G aspects as well. So different organizations are able to do this through active ownership strategies in the way they run their organizations and ensuring labor, fair labor practices, as well as in promoting diversity and inclusion, especially in gender. So maybe I'd just like to get your thoughts on this aspect of sustainability. And is this something that you've seen in practice? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, like you said, that the role is has been a little bit more focused on the energy side and environmental side. And the people are saying that at this time of the COVID-19, a little bit more attention is given to the social side, like the people's employment has to be saved and all those kind of stuff, and also the people's life at the same time. Again, the gender equality, LGBT inclusion and diversity, they are talking about it, but for me, it's sort of like given thing. And if you're not working for that, you're already out of the game in a way. And the world is consisted of many people and everything like that, and that's your market. And you really have to try to get their opinions on your services, on your product, on your marketing, and all those kind of things, and excluding them away from your decision-making process is nonsense for me. But then again, in reality, there are a lot of countries like in Japan and companies which cannot really do it, which is kind of like sad thing. And I believe that they need some time to just shifting into the new world for that. Talking about the governance, is again, this is a given thing. If you don't really have it, you're out of the game already.
That's quite interesting. I think in the same way that the other aspects of ESG, especially when it comes to climate, the transition has taken a long time. I think for companies and businesses to also transition into a more holistic approach to sustainability that also includes those other aspects, it will take some time, as you said. Jingdong?
Yeah, this is a very important point, Kat. So I'd like to spend a bit of time on this. So we address ESG is really to use the 17 United Nations SDG goals to highlight all the development challenges and the gaps, right, through our bond, sustainable development bond program. So that is quite a comprehensive recognition that each and every goal is important, and they cover the broad ESG, you know, from gender inequality to children's education, to poverty, to pollution, so on and so forth. So indeed, I'm very happy that investors generally have much more broadened their appetite from the narrow, you know, green bond to very much supporting our sustainable development bond. But I think because we have so much nomenclature here, you know, from SRI, ESG, and impact, my colleagues in the World Bank Treasury actually said, why don't we just use three alphabet ABCs of ESG, SRI, and impact. So let me elaborate a little bit, right? That is, A is to avoiding certain securities, issuers, or sectors the investor consider to be too risky, or that should be avoided for other reasons. This exclusion strategy is sometimes called socially responsible investing, often combined with investing based on values. The B is benefiting stakeholders by focus on minimizing ESG risk. And this is often referred to as ESG integration. And this strategy focuses on maximizing financial value by explicitly considering ESG risks. And finally, the C is what we call contributing to society, which is a goal that investors would pursue. So for fixed income, investors that pursue the strategy often look for labeled bonds and transparency around how issuers finance projects that they support. And of course, in real world, many investors use a combination of A, B, and C based on their appetite and strategy. Now, what we do in the World Bank Treasury is that we'd like to introduce global standard, right? From our executive membership in ICMA, in making global standard on green bond, a social impact bond, to our pioneer effort in the Green Bond Impact Report and the Sustainable Development Bond Impact Report, where we actually link the proceeds we raise from our bond to the actual projects we do in the World Bank. So the investors actually know where their money has been spent. So that global transparency is important. And we are also, we have launched an ESG portal where investors can log on to World Bank website to analyze how sovereigns, which all of them are member countries, how are they performing on ESG matters. So I think these are important public services that we provide at a global level to ensure that we can attract more and more investors into the space of ESG impact and SRI, which we call ABC. Yeah. Now, you know, I Kat, if I have a minute, I also wanted to bring another topic, which I think we actually started with. I think it is important. That is digital infrastructure. Just imagine if this COVID-19 had happened 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, I don't think that digital infrastructure then would have sustained a global lockdown where businesses and governments are still functioning. The fact that we are, you know, having this conversation is thanks to, you know, digital infrastructure doing an okay job. However, in developing countries, only about 35% of population have access to internet. And of the 25 least connected countries in the world, 21 are in Africa. Now, 1 billion people in the world cannot prove their identity, which limits their access to digital services, finance and opportunities. And of course, you know, women are often the victims. So 300 million fewer women than men in low and middle income countries have access to mobile internet. So how do we then use this crisis as a accelerator, you know, to make sure digital solution bandwidth, you know, access to the poorest population, and of course, supported by reliable electricity, energy, and you know, mobile technology, so on and so forth. I think this is where we may have to think of new bonds by the World Bank Treasury, specifically raising awareness on the need to build digital infrastructure. You know, a Broadband Commission estimates that around 100 billion will be needed to achieve universal access to broadband connectivity in Africa by 2030. So I would be very keen as World Bank and Treasury to be able to also use this to highlight the need for us to connect global savings to rapidly build up digital infrastructure to benefit the poor.
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that we've discussed today on the renewable energy side, sustainable infrastructure, digital, all of these things were pre-pandemic. We were very much aware that they were necessary. We needed more investment in that space. But indeed, what's happening right now is really showing how important these things are and the need to speed it up to get to a place where we're pandemic-proof or crisis-proof, if this is really what the future looks like. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today, and really looking forward to speak to you again. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to our channel. OMFEF episodes are available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.